All right. Hello. Happy Wednesday. Welcome to the Bloody Disgusting Podcast, everyone. The podcast where we discuss all the disgusting things in the world. So this is a bonus episode. So it's just me and Zena. But I'm here with a very special guest, the founder and executive of Boulder Light Pictures, a Horror Central production house in L.A., J.D. Lifshitz. Hello, J.D.
Hi. I was just...
Welcome.
Thank you so much. Thank God. I'm so happy to be here. You know, we were just talking about before I came on that I've been reading Bloody Disgusting since before I could shave. I mean, I started shaving at 22, so that's not even so impressive. Before I was supposed to be able to shave, I think I started reading Bloody Disgusting probably at 11 or 12. You know, very
awesome.
I think I met Brad Miska at a horror event for the first time when I was probably 14. So so this is very, very exciting for me.
Listen, I'm so excited to have you on. Like, even before we started talking. So I'm going to have to, like, fangirl, okay? I'm a huge fan of Boulder Light Pictures, and I'm a huge fan of you. I love your love for movies, for genre. Like, you can feel it when you're watching it. Like, I always say this. As someone who's been watching horror pretty much my whole life, like you, it's like, when you watch a movie, you can always tell if someone's not really a fan of the genre. But there's so many movies, like The Wrath of Becky is incredible. Barbarian had me screaming at my screen. And I even have like the bottle. I leave it in my living room. It has like the hair attached. You know, it's like my prize and joy. Of course, Gone in the Night, I love that one. The visual scared the crap out of me.
Thank you
forever.
So much.
I love, and of course, Pledge. Pledge is just like a good time. And
happy to hear you give some Pledge. Great. Thank you so much.
Such a fun movie. And again, I can keep on going, but I just want to thank you again for coming on and everything that you do.
It's my pleasure. Thank God. You know, I'm so grateful. I really appreciate you saying all that. Yeah, no, I always say we don't make movies for the Soho House, which is like a place where unhappy people hang out in LA. We make movies for 12-year-old us, right? We make movies for the people that are going to see a movie on a Saturday night and think, talk about it all week and think about it all year and listen to the soundtrack. That's what gets us very excited.
Yes.
And you know, again, like I am a massive fan, and I've always been a massive fan. My earliest memories are associated with storytelling, and specifically like darker genre storytelling. And you know, I was a kid who would take the train, as we were talking about this before we got on, to like go to Fangoria Weekend of Horrors and go to Monster Mania in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And you know, like, again, I read Bloody Disgusting. I read Dread Central. I read Shock Till You Drop. I remember when Ryan Turek was Ryan Rotten. This is such a delight, like, to be in something like this. It's just, you do interviews in this job, and the most exciting interviews are with places that we speak the same language. So this is
yes.
Really, really cool. And there was something that I was going to say on, in terms of the thank you for giving the shout outs to all these movies. I want to say one thing, which is the baby bottle, that was made for Barbarian is so cool to me. And it's especially cool because I remember being at a Fangoria convention when I was a kid and getting a Grace baby bottle. If you remember the movie Grace, from like 2007, Paul Sollett movie. And I still have it in my childhood bedroom. So it's just a bizarre thing that now we have a movie that has like a very similar sort of,
It's incredible. Like whenever people come over my house, because like I said, it's like, you see it when you walk right in the door, like.
And this is actually a very, I'll put the camera up, but that's like my favorite Barbarian alt poster that hangs in my office now.
It looks so good.
Thank you. It looks like a Goosebumps book.
I wanted to ask you, so with Boulder Light Pictures, how did that come about?
So it's sort of a long story, but I talk quickly. So it was I always loved genre movies. And Rafi, my business partner, we went to kindergarten together. We were always the two kids who just loved movies and loved horror movies. And I was probably a little more extreme. Like I knew who Fulci and Argento were. And he was more like he read Entertainment Weekly. I read Fangoria. But we both loved gnarly horror movies. And so like we would both swap stories on like who saw The Descent, who saw Hostel, you know, again, because we came of age. People talk derisively about the torture porn era, which is like not a real thing. It's sort of a straw man. It's torture porn was the elevated genre of its day, right? Where it's just like it's a thing people just say to either dismiss horror movies or kind of excuse them. But we actually made a slasher movie together in seventh grade. And the first credit in it, we have a copy of it in our office. The first credit in the movie, we had written out, this is why we're not directors, we'd written out the credits and put them in front of the camera. And the first credit we put was New Line Cinema Presents. So, like, we grew up on Dimension movies, on New Line movies, mm-hmm. on, like, the again, like, and, of course, the classics that predated us. And so we had always wanted to do this. And then, long story short, I was kicked out of my Hebrew school at 13 years old or so. And my dad used to say, and I, like, he loves telling the story too, because it's true. My dad was like, you want to make movies, your brothers want to be baseball players. It's not a real job. Because that's what it feels like when you grow up in some mm-hmm. small town in New York, you know, that you don't know anybody who's made. If you meet somebody who has an IMDb page with one credit from 30 years ago, they're the most famous person you've ever met in your life. Right. Yes. So to speak. And so it's like, I remember meeting Michael York, Basil Exposition from Austin Powers or Logan's Run, in a shoe store. And like, that was the most exciting thing that had happened that, you know. So anyways, I read in a Fangoria magazine that Eli Roth checked his own MySpace messages. And I said, that's my ticket into the business. So I made a MySpace page and I got in touch with Eli and he got back to me. And I started doing this with other filmmakers. I remember Jason Reitman, who's not a horror director, but produced Jennifer's Body and, mm-hmm. and directed Juno and Thank You for Smoking at the time, sent me a signed postcard in the mail. And stuff like that was just like, oh, you can have – these are real people. This is a real thing that you can do. Mm-hmm. And I started getting in touch with lots of the filmmakers. And I went to L.A. for the summer when I was 15 years old. I had an aunt who lives here. She still does. And I stayed by her house for the summer. And I just like go to the New Beverly Cinema, which is like a repertory theater in L.A. And I go there like every night. I got to know Clu Gulager that way, who's like from Nightmare on Elm Street 2 and Return of the Dead, among many others. And Feast, of course. And mm-hmm. and just got whatever relationships I could. And then when I was 19, I didn't take the SAT. This is not a – don't try this at home. I just like, this is the only thing, like it is this or work, like effectively like work at a video store, and video stores are disappearing because of streaming. And also I have too loud a voice to work in customer service. Like I have no indoor voice. I will be fired. So, I moved to Los Angeles, and I lived by that same aunt for 6 months. And I saw on Facebook that Adam Wingard, who'd done Your Next and The Guest, mm-hmm. but actually at the time, he'd done a movie called A Horrible Way to Die that I'd seen and been a fan of. Your Next had sold, but it had not come out yet. I had not seen it, but I wrote like a Rupert Pupkin level fan letter to them. And to Simon and Adam, I forget which one first. And was like, please give me this job, this position, or whatever. And they did. And then that was for ABCs of Death, which I actually have a cameo in with my yarmulke in the Q is for Quack segment. And then Rafi called me in 2012 and said, I think I can raise like $55,000 to make a movie. Can we make a movie for $55,000? And I'm like, absolutely, in my sleep. You know, El Mariachi was like $7,000. This is like almost 10 mm-hmm. times that amount. That's what happens if you don't go to college. And so he raised like $58,000. We made it for 55. And I was 19, he was 20. I would like wear blazers to set to try to look older, which doesn't work. It's like an old John Landis thing that like really got outdated. And I remember like going to the 99-cent store to like get the crafty and like set up the table. And we made this movie in 15 days in LA for roughly the budget called Contracted. And IFC picked it up in North America, and it was a huge sleeper hit for them. Howard Stern mm-hmm. got behind it. We had a limited theatrical release in 2013, but did extraordinarily well on cable video on demand and Netflix. And we didn't like the job that our foreign sales agent was doing, so we said, give us a ride back, we'll do this ourselves. So we booked a basement booth in the Palais in Cannes, carried the posters, shared an Airbnb with a stranger, and we went to the Hollywood Play just hustling. And like, for example, where we were at Cannes was like where Louis Kaufman is. Like really just where you get the free coffee, and you just come out and attack people and like, please, please look at our movie. Right. But through doing that, we got these great relationships around the world. So, for example, again, in Hong Kong, Contracted opened the top 10 theatrically. I knew a kid who was studying abroad there at NYU who was like, there's bus ads for your movie here. And you know, following that, we got these great slate financing and co-production deals because you just meet different people in different places. So, like, we did a deal with this place called Making Film in Hong Kong with our good friends Su Liang and Pang Ho Chung. In fact, it's not going to be one of the movies I picked, but I could plug it here right now. Pang Ho Chung, who financed several of our films starting out and is a dear friend, directed one of the most messed up movies ever made, which is called Dream Home. It's a Hong Kong slasher movie.
Yes.
There's a pregnancy sequence in that movie mm-hmm. that's just insane. So Pong is mostly known for like romantic comedies, and but he directed this one extremely graphic genre movie, and has threatened to do another one. And Pong financed a bunch of movies for us, and is just the man. We love this guy. He's like an uncle to us. And then we, and then you know, another one was Senator Tim Chuan Macau, they worked with, and then this company MM2 in Singapore, who's a publicly traded money laundering throughout Southeast Asia. They did a great deal with us, and they've been really wonderful partners. And I'd be remiss not to mention them. Anyways, follow, you know, to fast forward, we were just in production on our 21st movie since 2012. Mostly it's been horror. You know, Becky's sort of an action movie, although it definitely like leans like we always I to quote Gordon Gekko, to paraphrase Gordon Gekko, gore is good. You know what I'm saying? Like my biggest complaint with both Becky movies is that they're not bloody enough, and we're hoping to fix that with maybe another one soon. There's your, you know, a little tidbit. Yeah. But I have talked about how, it's so funny because we did Wrath of Becky and I love Matt and Sue's, the writer directors were very close. And I was like, it's not bloody enough. And that's not their fault. You know, it's a rush, but there's a lot, you only have so many days in production. It was a very ambitious movie for what we had. But I remember like, oh, I'm really concerned that this movie is not like, we got an NC-17 on Becky one. We had to cut it down. Becky two got an R on the first run, which was like frustrating to me. Because for me, it's like the stamp of honor when I was a kid was you got an NC-17. If you were a proper genre movie, you got an NC-17. And we got an R, and I was like pretty frustrated. And then everybody I talked to were like, the kills are great. So, I guess it doesn't matter. I guess whether it's the My Bloody Valentine original R-rated cut or unrated cut, people can project what they want to project. But, and then we had a movie called, obviously, The Vigil, which is very personal to us, and we love that movie dearly. And that was at TIFF in 2019. And then we, we mostly focus on, we mostly want to, you know, give audiences, I like to say, the best time they can have sober. Like what is, I think horror and comedy, which are two genres that we really love. Obviously I can probably teach a class on horror, cinema, certainly. And probably just the genre in general. Horror and comedy are both genres that rely on, I'm not saying I would get any students because again, without having an indoor voice, sometimes it's too abrasive, but genuinely horror and comedy are both genres that need to feel unsafe, which I think is like very present for what the conversation we're about to have. It's like, for me, it's, and when I say that, I don't mean that it needs to be mean spirited, right? Like it's not, I mean that like, cause people are like, oh, you should never punch down. I'm like, the best horror movies and the best comedies both punch down. That's not, the problem is never, I was just talking about this earlier today. The problem is not punching down. The problem is why you're punching, right? So it's like the difference between South Park and Carlos Mencia, and I'm sorry to him if he's listening or watching, is that South Park is in the name of comedy. They are trying to make you laugh. They're trying to give you a good time. Mm-hmm. Some comics, I don't even want to pick on Carlos Mencia, but you have comics that feel like they're just trying to like, at a certain point, they're just trying to egg you on. And that to me has never been, there's a great Stuart Gordon quote, which is the late great, which was Godzilla destroying a city is not scary. A person taking a pin to their finger very slowly is scary. Sometimes, again, intention matters. So I think that, like, horror and comedy both need to feel unsafe. They need to feel like anything can happen. They need to feel dangerous, fundamentally. Mm-hmm. And I think generally, right? And that's really what we think about. We have a responsibility. Also, I really am very honest, sometimes to the chagrin of my partner. Like, I if I don't like a movie, I do not believe in lying. The best I can do is keep my mouth shut. And you're seeing how good I am at that. I genuinely just are the thing. Boulder Light started because Rafi and I had a shared desire to make the kinds of movies that we want to see. And that is the thing that we are obsessed with. Like, is just how do we give audiences, I was saying this before we got on, but like my job is to give audiences the feeling I got when I would go to a video store as a kid and I saw, or a bookstore even, and saw the horror section. If a store, because sometimes they wouldn't have it. They would just have thriller, or they'd have mystery and suspense, you know? Or, like, sometimes you'd have to look for, like, Stephen King in, like, the fantasy section at your bookstore. Like, but when a bookstore had a horror section, there was a feeling I got that's, like, inexplicable. I can't even articulate how that made me feel. And movies are and TV are an opportunity to communicate telepathically and give that feeling over. And that's the gold standard, right? That is the thing that I'm always chasing. And, you know, thank God, again, I'm very grateful insofar as we continue to be able to do that. That's like, that's the thing that we're completely obsessed with. It's a vibe, so to speak. Right. And when I say that, I don't mean vibe in the way that like the movie is a vibe. No. I mean, it's a feeling that the movie should give you constantly. And it can't just be a feeling, because I think that movies need to just be more than atmosphere. But atmosphere is fundamental. And I also want to say to anybody living in Los Angeles, the Barnes & Noble's at the Grove now has a horror section. So you might as well support it if you're not going to go to Dark Galaxies.
Absolutely. Like, even with you talking about like the different films that you guys are a part of, let's use Barbarian as an example. And I also feel this way about The Visual, because The Visual really creeped me out. But with Barbarian, it's like, it was very much unexpected, right? It took us on a journey. And I usually don't watch trailers because I like to go into the movie blind, but I watched this trailer. I couldn't help myself, you know, and I watched myself. And at first, you know, we see the young woman, she pulls up and it's just like, no, don't go in there. Like, that's what I was saying. What are you doing? But then it just gets bananas. Like, that's the best word I feel that describes the movie. And I just love every second of it. The feeling that I had, because I enjoyed it so much, it brought me back to my childhood, because it made me laugh. It scared me. You know, there's some dark stuff that's going on, but I want it more, you know? And so it's just like, I feel like when a movie does that for me, takes me back to like my childhood, I feel like that's just something that I have to keep watching, you know?
Of course. No, and that's really, a friend of mine who's a filmmaker, I think I can call her out because I want to give credit where it's due. Mariama Diallo said this very, who directed a wonderful film called Master, if you haven't seen it.
Yes.
Very good movie. Mariama texted me that she told a friend of hers that these are the types of movies we used to see when we were kids. That's it, right? It's not, when I say that, I don't mean in a throwback fashion, right? Because I don't think that, like, I'm not looking to make regressive movies. I don't mean that politically. I mean that, like, intellectually, viscerally. Like, I don't want to make, if you want to go watch, like, I love early John Carpenter, right? Mm-hmm. I want to give people the feeling that I felt when I saw an early John, when I saw, you know, In the Mouth of Madness for the first time. That's not early, that's late John Carpenter or mid John Carpenter, but you get the idea. But I don't want to make that movie, because that movie exists. So it's like, the thing that I'm chasing, Spielberg has like one of the best examples I've heard of this, where he's like, when he's making Raiders of the Lost Ark, he wants to do his version of Flash Gordon. And he goes back and he watches the old Flash Gordons and he's like, these are terrible. Like, this is not at all what I remember. I want to make the movie I had in my head. And so it's like, granted, with like John Carpenter movies or Wes Craven movies or you know, Tobey Hooper movies, they're great. So they actually are great movies, which makes the job maybe harder, you know? But it does mean that you're filtering it through your own prism, right? Like, the thing I love, the thing I get so excited about when I see a great horror movie is, like, I think Smile recently was a good example of this for me, because I think Parker Finn was able to, who did a Vigil Q&A for us at the New Beverly, I'm still grateful, very nice of him as a buddy to do that, but Parker Finn with Smile, I had the feeling that I was watching The Ring again. I had the feeling that I was watching the original Candyman again, right? There are so many things he does in that movie that are familiar, but through his own lens. And that's why the movie is exciting to me, as opposed to just like, you know, or even Alex Aja's remake of The Hills Have Eyes, which is, I think, is one of the greatest remakes of all time. I think it's a true masterpiece. That movie is not just a retelling of like Wes Craven's movie. Like, that is actually the best example of what I'm talking about. Where, like, that movie feels like a 70s horror movie, but there is no horror movie from the 70s that feels like that movie, because it is just an Alex Aja movie, right? It exists on its own terms. And I think the only way to move the genre forward and to give new audiences new things to want to copy and new things to fall in love with is to do things through your own perspective and not, again, you're inspired by the past, but you're not trying to recreate the past, because the past is past.
Yeah. And I love that you mentioned the movie Smile. I really love that one as well. Like, especially like something like the soundtrack, like their sound. Oh my goodness. So good. When I went to the theaters, I was the only one in there and it scared me.
Oh,
and
that's
I was so happy, you know, as weird as that sounds, but it was a great experience.
That's amazing. That's fantastic. Yeah.
But speaking of things that scare you, well, because I was talking about that for me. I want to know what scares you.
You know, it's funny. As a kid, the two scariest things that I can remember, the three scariest things that I can remember seeing, or you know what? I'll just do four really quickly, and then I'll really just four, because they're very different. One is there's an image of the guy falling in the water, and I know what he did last summer, and for whatever reason, the movie didn't scare me, but that image scared me. Two, the It miniseries scared me in the way that the first half of it scared me in a way that I think every rational child who saw that was disturbed. Like, that was the most frightening I'd ever seen in my life. Nightmare on Elm Street, I remember being so scared when I saw that movie for the first time. I must have been 6, maybe 7 years old. I remember being so scared when I saw the movie for the first time that I immediately was like, I have to go rent Freddy's Dead so I know how to kill him if he come for me. Fun fact, Freddy's Dead and Freddy's Nightmares pilot, both written by, and In the Mouth of Madness, all written by our esteemed chairman at Warner Brothers, Mike DeLuca, who is a true fan. Like, Mike loves horror. He actually does. I was in a marketing meeting with him where he brought up In Search of Darkness, the Shudder documentary. Like, he's one of us, and it's the coolest thing to get to work at a studio that he ever sees. And then the fourth is actually, there's an episode of a short-lived R.L. Stine show called The Nightmare Room, called Scareful, What You Wish For, that is like the other scariest thing I saw as a kid, which is, features Shia LaBeouf as a kid, as a teenager who starts getting stalked by this little kid played by Dylan and Cole Sprouse, the kids from Big Daddy, and now The Suite Life, whatever, in Riverdale. And it's just, there is something about that episode. There's a big reveal in it. And there's something about that episode that is staggeringly disturbing and scary. And I think you totally do again. And nobody has seen it, but me. And, I'm not even sure. I've spoken to Dylan Sprouse. I don't even know if he's seen it. But I suggest everybody track this down. I don't know if it holds up, but when I was revisiting it a couple of years ago, I felt like it did kind of hold up. Those things really scared me as a kid, and Candyman. As an adult, the original, as an adult, I basically never get scared for movies. The three scariest experiences I had in a movie theater as an adult are in order, Sinister, Hereditary, Smile. Sinister is probably the only one that I was scared when I left the theater. The other two, I was just scared in the theater. Generally, if I'm scared now, it's because of a documentary or real footage that I saw of something. I'm not really scared of fiction. I'm scared of the things that my mind does when I'm mm-hmm. like getting into bed at night, right? But that's sort of like this primal feeling that probably exists on the back of all of the gnarly, crazy horror stuff I've inundated myself with for 30 years.
Absolutely. And then real quick, before we dive into our lists, do you have like a favorite subgenre in horror?
It's an excellent question. As a little boy, it was probably the slasher. That was probably the one that I was like most obsessed with. I was like, this is how messed up I was as a kid. I would go online and there were websites where you could see the body count. And I would read about the body count of like Night of the Demons 2, you know? And then additionally, I also would go on like Arrow in the Head, the John Fallon's website, and read the gore mm-hmm. count. Like, just crazy. I was like a big slasher guy. But as an adult, I love ambitious horror. It's not for me. It's more just a mindset. Like, I love horror movies that want to be the greatest horror movie you've ever seen. I love horror movies that just feel, all my favorite movies now as an adult generally are just bold visions, right? Like, somebody wants to grab you by the throat and not let go. And that can be The Sixth Sense, and that can be, mm-hmm. Get Out. Like, that can be any variety of different things. I just love movies that feel abrasive and loud. Yeah. You know, I don't mean loud literally. I mean, like, mm-hmm. you know, they're announcing themselves in a way that kind of, for me now, transcends genre. But within that, just anything that, for me, that becomes more important than the specific subgenre, right. I think.
Okay. And then I know I said one more question before we dive into our list, but I just thought of one. Okay. So, okay, you have such a, I like that you're straightforward. You know, you go after what you want. You're not apologetic about liking genre, just very straightforward. So how do you keep that energy? Like, how do you not let people try to like dampen it down? You know what I mean?
This is like one of the best questions I've ever been asked, because this is the most important thing about working in the entertainment industry. Mm-hmm. Professionally. Like, thank God. Like, what I've come to realize is that like a lot of the things that were liabilities to me when I was a kid are superpowers as an adult. And they are a lot of things that they tried to beat out of me when I came here, right? Because being a non-financing independent producer is like having leprosy in the 16th century. It's like just the ugliest thing you can be. Nobody wants to talk to an independent producer who's not financing, right? Who has to look for the money. Right. And thankfully it's changed, right? But at the time it was really isolating. And I desperately wanted to be part of whatever my version of the Splat Pack would be, right? Now, I was younger than anybody I really knew. Rafi and I both were younger than anybody we knew when we moved here, because we were kids, right, ultimately. And we loved horror. And I foam at the mouth about it. And people would look at me like I was nuts. Like, they're just like to quote to the marketing campaign for Last House to Left, it's only a movie, but in a negative sense, right? They were just like, why are you so, you know? And it's like, these are hours of people's lives they're never going to get back. You have to deliver for them. But I remember we had a meeting with Jason Blum, which was really wonderful and inspiring. And Jason basically was like, you guys aren't, in so many words, was like, you guys aren't the crazy ones. Everyone else is crazy, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, in the sense of like, but that aside, the thing that I think was most powerful for me, above all else, is like, we are the two things that ruin movies the most, I would say, are ego and apathy. Like, not caring about what you're doing is why most movies are bad. Mm-hmm. And that is like my favorite filmmakers. And we talked about this a little bit before we got on, but my favorite filmmakers that I've had the privilege to meet, we all speak the same language, which is there is a love and a childlike nature. Like, that point of purity is where I come to make movies from, right? I am constantly in dialogue with my childhood self, because that's the thing that is the most transferable. And that is the thing that is the most rewarding. This business, like, the most important thing you can do for yourself is not allow yourself to get jaded, because when you watch even a movie like Killers of the Flower Moon, when you watch a Scorsese movie, mm-hmm. that's a guy who's making movies with the same energy he was making movies with 50 years ago, you know? And that's how you keep making great movies ultimately, right? That to me transcends genre. And the truth is, I don't know how to do it any other way. Mm-hmm. Like, I am, like, my wife is not a genre fan. But she tolerates me, and she doesn't. I'll come home and I'm just like, I'm just obsessed with it, right? I'm like, mm-hmm. telling her facts about like why Lucio Fulci's Zombie 2 is called Zombie 2, right? Mm-hmm. It's just the way that I grew up inhaling this stuff. It is a language that I've always kind of innately understood. Thank God, the thing that I'm most grateful for is, again, it's a responsibility to make movies. It's not a human right, right? It's something that I am grateful for, and that I pinch myself every day for, and that I take seriously the responsibility of delivering for an audience. Like, the audience doesn't owe you anything except a good faith watch, that they're going to watch it with an open mind, that they want to have a good time when they watch it, right? If somebody goes in hating something, maybe that's bad faith, whatever. But the audience doesn't owe you liking your movie, right? And I think that's another real problem, is that a lot of executives, like, they're flippant. I joke, I've worked with on various different like franchises, and in certain situations of working with an executive, I'm like, not only do I not think they've seen the original movie in this franchise, I don't think they've ever seen a movie, right? And I'm like, that's kind of a joke. That is technically a joke, but it's like, mm-hmm. you know, people just don't care. They don't care. And it's just like, on a foundational level, it's just not how we approach this. And so thank God, I'm extremely grateful for that. It's just the only way that I know how to operate. It makes things more fun. It makes food taste better. And it's like, you know, the coolest thing is when you get to go you know, when you get to see yourself in a Fangoria magazine, or like you get to go, you know, it's like you get to go to a horror, like I get to go to Fright Fest and like watch, you know, a bunch of these movies. And like I constantly have to remind myself, you know, I was saying this before we came on, but we were making Barbarian in Bulgaria. Every time I would have a tough day and like think about how much I miss my family or what have you, I had a playlist of songs I would listen to when I was like 14 years old. And I would just play it and walk around Sofia, Bulgaria, and just be like, this is my job. I get to be in another country making a crazy horror movie. I have nothing. If I complain, I should punch myself in the face.
Man. Oh, it's just a magical life that you have.
Thank God. I'm so grateful for it. And the truth of the matter is, when I was a child, I was utterly miserable. Like, cause I was like, everyone is like, I was so miserable as a kid, like from the ages of like 13 to 19 was utterly isolating. Just like awful, you know, because you want to do something. Everyone thinks you're nuts. Even when Rafi and I moved to LA, and again, there was a sense of delusion that we came here, right? Mm-hmm. You had to be a little insane to do that. Like it was that was isolating, right? Yeah. Like it's still a very difficult job, but if you don't love it, it's not only is it impossible, I don't know why you would ever do it, because the rewarding things about it are rewarding and products of caring, right? Like they're results of caring. So, you know, again, I take nothing for granted, and thank God I genuinely, like I'm so, so grateful. I want to give, like a lot of people say they're their own harshest critic. I really think I am among the most harsh critics of the movies that we make. And directors that we've worked with will attest to this. Sometimes for better, you know, sometimes it gets me into trouble. Like I'm not shy about saying how I feel, and I won't say that I love something that I don't love. At least I try never to say something that's not true.
That's good. No, but seriously, kind of like what I already told you before we even started recording, I really do feel like you are very inspiring. Thank you. And again, I feel like when it comes to Boulder Light Pictures, you and Raphael are doing, like, I feel like your movies, like, they never miss for me. You know, I always end up having, like, the best time watching it.
Thank you
so much. Kudos to you both.
Thank you so much. You know, thank God. I'm so grateful. And that means so much. And, like, genuinely, you know, like, I am the person who's like, constantly looking at the lineup at, like, again, Monster Mania, for example, and being like, why are we not here? You know, why are we not going? I was telling Tracy, my VP, like, you have to start, like, one of us, Rafi and I have kids. It's like hard to travel, but and by the way, that doesn't mean I won't do it. I want to do it.
Right.
I just have to like negotiate it with my wife. But I'm like, we have to have a, like, this is, you know, this is the community that we work for. We don't work for Hollywood executives. We work for the ticket buying public. Right.
And you guys, you're doing it. Like, I just, again, I feel like you care about the genre.
Thank you so much.
I won't name movies, but there's, you know, certain movies sometimes when I think about, you know, they have like this big push behind them, which is cool, but there's just something that's hollow, something
synthetic,
that's missing.
Yeah.
So, and I'm just a viewer. So clearly this is what I'm feeling, you know, and I'm seeing it.
Thank you so much.
Okay, of course. All right. So now we're going to talk about the top three most effed up horror movies that we've ever seen. And you are our guest, so you can go first with your first movie.
Oh no! So I'm gonna pick three that are more cerebral than visceral. Like they're more like emotionally upsetting than two of them are more emotionally upsetting than violent. And I don't know if they're the three most disturbing movies. One of them is very violent, but I don't know if they're the most disturbing movies I've ever seen. But they're three movies that really impacted me. And I'm not going to pick documentaries, because I feel like that's cheating. Like that's a different sort of feeling. But I'm going to pick, the reason I'm doing this, like, I'm not picking, like, they're the obvious, like, I'm not picking like Cannibal Holocaust or Audition, which are movies that are like, yeah, those movies are really messed up, but they're messed up in a really kind of like playful, playful is the wrong word, but they're visceral. They're like daring you to watch them. Right. That's like titillating when you're a kid to a certain extent, but it's not disturbing. I'm not thinking at night, trying to get it out of my head. Right. And so I'm picking three movies that like really upset me in a way that, that felt dangerous. They felt bizarrely off-putting. And the first one that I'll list is a movie called 10 Rillington Place by the great Richard, late great Richard Fleischer. Richard Fleischer directed such a wide variety of movies. He's one of the only filmmakers that started in the old Hollywood system and really worked up until like 1989. And then he only died in 2001. So he wrote a great book in the 90s. Like he was a phenomenal filmmaker, and he made everything from 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea with Kirk Douglas to Amityville 3D with Dino De Laurentiis. Like he was a guy who just did so many different kinds of movies. And 10 Rillington Place is a movie that he made with Richard Attenborough and John Hurt. And it's a British movie about a real serial killer named John Christie, who's referenced actually in Frenzy, Hitchcock's movie. But he was a very famous serial killer in the UK. And just, you talk about a movie that's about the banality of evil, which is something that gets thrown around a lot. It's similar to Killers of the Flower Moon, but this movie is not nearly as long if you were scared by that running time. This movie's very tight. And this movie really feels, and I love Killers of the Flower Moon. That wasn't a knock. I just know it's not everybody's cup of tea. This movie is... It makes for me Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer look like the Ted Bundy Zac Efron movie. Like it's not. It's Whoa. I only mean in terms of how polished. Like it's not.
No, right, right, yeah.
I mean just in terms of like this is not a humane movie. This is a movie about the abyss inside of man's like core. You know what happens if you're just filled with animus, so to speak. When I say abyss, I just mean you know there is no silver lining to this movie. It is so bleak. It is so dark. It is so harrowing. And the performances all feel, again, if you told me this was a documentary, I wouldn't believe you because I know these actors and I know this filmmaker. But if I didn't, I'd still not believe you because we're watching actual murders happen. But it's a good case to make. The movie is so scary and just unnerving and just awful. You need a shower after it. I think I did this as Trailers from Hell for Joe Dante. Like I talk about this movie all the time, but it is just the most upsetting and powerful serial killer movie that I think I've ever seen. We did a movie with Anna Kendrick called Woman of the Hour that'll be on Netflix, I think, in August sometime next year. I don't know when. I'm just guessing. Okay. And that that movie, one of the reference points, was 10 Rillington Place. In terms of just how hardcore it goes. That's my first pick. Okay, I would say runner up. I could have also used The Boston Strangler, sorry to jump in, which is Richard Fleischer's Tony Curtis 1968 serial killer movie, which is the second most disturbing serial killer movie I've ever seen. And nothing to do with the remake with Keira Knightley. I'm sorry.
No, you're good. I've never heard of the movie.
Yeah.
And I looked it up and I just saw that it's available on Pluto TV, so I'm going to check it out tonight.
It's the ultimate feel bad experience.
I can't wait. Okay, so that's your first one. So the first one I'm going to go with as well is this movie called Cal Vair, aka The Ordeal, from 2004. I don't know if you ever watched a movie that just made like your armpits sweaty, like it just like stressed you out. And I feel like this is what this movie did. It's basically about this guy. He's a musician. He's cutting through this small town. His car breaks down. Pretty much everybody in that town, they're gross. They're psychopaths. And it's just like, I would never want to be in that situation. Like I felt like I never wanted to watch the movie again. Like again, like not trying to sound like, oh, my sweaty armpits. But yeah, whenever I get like nervous, that's what happens. And I like, it's just crazy that a movie made me do that. So I think in my lifetime, I only watched it one time. And this was like back in like 2004, like when I was in high school in 2004. So it's just kind of like wow. Never again. But yeah, there's still particular scenes that live in my mind.
That, it's so funny. That movie was going to be remade. I won't say much about it because I don't know if it's private, whatever. But I will say a notable horror actor wrote the remake. And it was going to be remade. I don't think it'll happen, but or maybe it will. I have no idea. But I remember reading a remake version of it years ago. That's a great. My next pick is a French New Extremism movie. And obviously, there are so many to choose from. There are fake ones like Martyrs, because that's, I think that's French-Canadian, technically. And then you have, obviously, High Tension, which is you know, speaking of Aja, just such a incredible movie. One of the greatest slit throats in cinema history. And I think that was Fulci's guy who did the effects. I could be wrong. And then of course you have Incendies. That's another great movie, but Interiors. But I'm actually thinking of Inside, which is a like powerhouse of a movie. And I'm specifically talking about it's the goriest movie on the list that I'm gonna pick. And that's a movie that I wanted to remake when I was 20 years old. We just made Contracted, and I was like, this is a movie that like you could actually remake, and you can do a job, and you can do a different thing with it, but you can use that premise. That premise is so good. And there's so many great things in it, but like there's ways to, I think, even push it further, whatever. And I got in touch with the rights holder, and they were like, great, that'll be $250,000. And I'm like, oh yeah, I can't. Okay. That's we just made our first, we were 50,000. I can't do that. I can't raise that kind of money for rights. But anyway, regardless, Inside is it's a woman home alone. She's about to give birth. Her husband has died in a horrible accident sometime before. And she gets a knock at the door, and it's a woman asking to use the phone, and she doesn't let her in because she's smart. And then the woman keeps coming back, and at a certain point, and this is sort of a spoiler, but so you can mute me for 3 seconds as I say that the woman calls her by her name. And that is when the movie just goes bananas. This is the only time in a movie that I've been upset at gore. And when I say upset, not because I was physically ill from the gore, I wasn't. That would probably be Jennifer Kent's The Nightingale, which could be on this list, but I won't put it on this list. I love that movie. But that movie's not really horror at all. But this in the sense that like I actually thought the first half of this movie is one of the scariest movies of the 21st century. And I think the gore makes it feel safer. It makes it feel less it makes it feel less dangerous because it's fun and it goes from being really scary to kind of fun. But there is a money shot in this movie that I will not spoil, but that is very obviously coming, and it's kind of on the poster of the Dimension Extreme label.
All right.
DVD that just is like shocking. And the movie is it's my favorite of the French New Extreme movies, slightly in front of High Tension. And that movie doesn't get enough love.
That is a good one. I was late to watching that one. I think I watched that one maybe like a couple of years ago.
Oh yeah, I have the Dimension Extreme DVD.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay, so number two on my list, I recently watched this movie. It's called Antichrist.
Of course.
Came out in 2000. Oh my God.
I turned 17 the year that movie came out. I say that not to date myself. I say that because I remember having a conversation about, oh, that should be the first R-rated movie we go to. Like that, it wasn't. I ended up going to another movie as my first R-rated movie. And it wasn't a horror movie. But the day I turned 17, I went to the Landmark Sunshine to see my first R-rated movie. But Antichrist, I remember, came out around the same time, and that was a conversation that would be the first one. Yeah.
Ooh. I've heard about it for a while. People would say, like, oh, wow, this movie's a lot. And I'm like, is it? You know? Because, you know, you watch, like, a lot of stuff you think is fine. Yeah. This movie ruined my life. And I don't know if it's in the best way. It's very bleak. It's twisted. There's a little bit of like art house flair that's to it. But I mean, even though it's like, it's one of those movies where I'll never watch it again, it is filmed beautifully, like gorgeous film. There's a lot of mutilation going on. I'll never watch it again though, like at all.
Yeah,
like help.
It's not a fun movie. I've heard. Yeah, that pick totally makes sense. my third pick would be actually sort of related to my second pick, in the sense that it has a very similar opening, but I think it is one of the all time great horror sequels. And that is When a Stranger Calls Back, which was made for television in the 1990s by the great Fred Walton, who directed When a Stranger Calls, also April Fool's Day, I believe. And When a Stranger Calls Back is the first Legacy sequel I've ever seen. In fact, they were going to make a third one with Dimension that they ended up canceling later on. But it's the first Legacy sequel I've ever seen, and it starts and you think it's going to be similar to the original one of Stranger Calls, which is also great. It is much more hardcore. And there is a sequence in a hospital in this movie that is not bloody, but it's just so messed up. It's so, like, perverse and weird and crazy. And what the character, what the antagonist in this movie does is just so disturbing and just, again, fetishistic. And I just think that that movie is kind of a gold standard in terms of how you up the ante for a sequel. Again, it's a made-for-TV movie from the 1990s. So there are things that, like, you might find dated, you might find boring. I don't think this movie is boring. I don't think this movie is dated. I'm saying this because I made everybody in my office watch it, and somebody told me this. But I think this movie is like, and it is if you like what Scream did, meaning the new Screams, the radio silence Screams, or if you like what David Gordon Green did with Halloween, this is the first example of it that I've ever seen where they're actually making a legacy sequel. I think it's, with all due respect to Radio Silence and David Gordon Green, I think it's scarier than those movies. Like, it manages to maintain the sheer terror of the original, whilst having fun with the, like, canon nature of it. I really, that movie, nobody talks about it, but it is, I would call it a gore de force, but it's not even gory. The inside is a gore de force. But yeah, that's when A Stranger Calls Back, which I believe is 93.
It's been a while since I've seen it, but I'm completely down with made-for-TV horror movies.
Me too.
Like, that's 100% my jam.
Yes, absolutely. You know, there's a lot of great made-for-TV horror, and a lot of it is, like, cemented into me. I mean, again, like, the It miniseries was made-for-TV horror miniseries, right? Like, especially in the 70s, you had so many interesting made-for-TV horror movies and series. And you had, again, filmmakers like Wes Craven and John Carpenter making movies for television.
Yes. One of my favorite Wes Craven made-for-TV movies. Oh my gosh, now it just ran away from me. Is this movie from the 70s. Linda Blair's in it.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yes, that movie. I was obsessed with the movie. Like, I used to watch it a lot when I was, like, a teen. Because it would air on cable all the time.
I never saw these things on cable. I'm just like, so when we were growing up, I used to watch the Sci-Fi Network. That's where I saw all the Wishmaster movies. And, like, I like,
oh, cool.
They play the Amityville movies. Yeah, like, I used to watch the Sci-Fi Network back when it was SCIFI. And then I remember there was Monsters HD briefly, which was amazing. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember watching Tales from the Dark Side in HD on that network and just having my mind blown. I remember as a kid, my parents got TiVo, which is the biggest deal in the world. And I remember TiVoing Psycho 2, the Tom Holland written Psycho sequel. Tom Holland, Child's Play, obviously not Spider-Man, who wasn't born when the movie came out. And I remember, I'm not joking, TiVoed Psycho 2. We went on, like, a family trip, came back, and our house had a fire. I don't know if our house had a fire or TiVo had been erased. Something happened that it was taken off TiVo, and I remember just being crushed.
You know? I'm sorry.
It's okay. what can you, you know, it should be the worst thing. Those are my picks.
Okay, those are some awesome picks. Okay. For my last one, I'm going with the Taiwanese horror, The Sadness, 2021. Yeah, he's incredible. Like, this is so weird because it's like, when I tell people that I like horror, it's kind of like, either they don't believe me, or if I give them a recommendation, I never hear from them again.
Right.
But you said you wanted to be surprised. That's what you said. So,
yes.
No spoilers, but throughout this whole movie, horrible things happen, and there's a particular thing that happens with an eye socket that just, I've never seen it before, and it's just, it's gross, it's disturbing. I don't know, but in a way, I feel like people, if you can stomach it, I feel like people should experience it if you can.
Yeah, I think the most notable thing for me about that train sequence that you're referring to is like the way it starts, because the filmmaking mm-hmm. is so good. Like, that's the thing.
Yes.
That's, I was talking to, I'll name drop specifically because if this person hears it, he'll love that I name dropped him. I was hanging out with Rob Savage, director of Host and The Boogeyman, awesome. A couple of days ago. And we were talking, and I brought up Mother's Day, which he had never seen. So I'll also take this mm-hmm. opportunity to show his ignorance. And not having seen the original Charles Kaufman Mother's Day. If you haven't seen Mother's Day, it's a messed up movie, right? It's like the most, that and Combat Shock are like the two trauma movies that are like famously actually disturbing. But the filmmaking's really good. And like, that's the most notable thing about it is like, when you can see it's good faith, bad faith. B, it's like, is this being done by someone who actually has a point of view and is like a legitimate artist? Or is this just like, there is a big difference between, and I say this not to knock because I am a fan of these movies too. And I think that this guy was an innovator, but there's a difference between like Herschel Gordon Lewis and Stuart Gordon, right? In terms mm-hmm. of what they're doing. There is gore for gore's sake at a certain point stops being disturbing. And it's just like, can become sort of just like pornographic. But the amazing thing about like a move, you know, when you can take something, and that this is really what we strove for with Barbarian, you know, when you can take something that feels like a full moon gutter movie and you mm-hmm. can inject it with kind of an A sensibility, right? And I don't mean that like Transfers is a great movie. Like, I'm not saying this is like, but there are limitations that those movies have. And I think that the great thing that the greatest genre filmmakers do, again, whether it's Carpenter with The Thing or Aja with his Hotels of Eyes remake, or like, you know, obviously Quentin Tarantino, this is his whole thing, and Spielberg with the old 50s serials. If you can give the B movies that we love, again, B in terms of the fact that they didn't have the budgets to do what they wanted to do and they didn't have the resources, whatever, and give them an A sensibility and really respect them. I mean, that's what Sam Raimi has been doing, right? Evil Dead 2 is really just what he would have wanted to do with Evil Dead 1 had he had the resources. Mm-hmm. It would seem, right? Dawn of the Dead to Night of the Living Dead. Like, you know, and that's within their own oeuvre, and those movies are great in their own right, right? They don't have limitations a lot of these other movies do in any capacity, but that to me is what's so noticeable about Jabez as a filmmaker, is like that kind of like uncomfortable exchange between that man and that woman that starts that sequence.
Yes.
Just sets the table, you know.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. I have only watched it one time, I'm not gonna lie.
All you need. Know,
yeah. It's one of those movies. Yeah. I love gore. I love zombies. They're kind of like zombies, like very unhinged yeah. type of zombies with no chill. So that's just always like a good time for me.
That makes sense.
Okay. Yeah, that's our list. But before you go, I do have a question for you, if you can answer. Are there any projects that you can mention that we can keep an eye out for?
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Well, of course, there is Weapons, which I can't say anything about other than to say, which is Zach Cregger's Follows the Barbarian, other than to say it's one of the best scripts I've ever read. I jumped out of my seat reading it with joy. Like, I genuinely can't stress enough. This script is unbelievable. I hope that, you know, again, I'm so excited for the movie. We have a movie called Companion that is shooting right now that is science fiction also. It's more of a, it's not a straight horror movie at all, but it's surprising, I think, and I hope, and we have some of the team from Barbarian on it, and I'm very excited about it. And I think what it does do also is that it is just a great time at the movies. It's very surprising. It's got thrills. It might have kills. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's without saying too much, there's a, mm-hmm. It is a movie where you want to go in knowing as little as possible as you did on Barbarian. In terms of what else we can mention right now, without me getting in trouble, and within the genre, I mean, we have a movie called Threshold that's like a Carpenter-esque horror movie that we're working on right now that will probably be announced imminently. We'll find out, and then we've got something with Rob Savage that is like one of the most exciting scripts I've like this is like I think can be a new horror classic, God willing. It's okay. All I'll say about it is it's like The Hills Have Eyes meets Seven in New York City.
Sold.
Yeah, it's really, really messed up. But there's, you know, again, like we're constantly, we have a couple of projects with a couple of different directors that I think, like right now, I've never been as excited about a slate as the one we have now. You know, thank God. I mean, that's really the goal always is how do we outdo ourselves, right? How do we, like, I think Wrath of Becky is better than Becky One. And I think that was not an accident. Like we went in, you know, I was a kid who was raised on Dimension and New Line sequels, right? And the sequels oftentimes for me, they would up the ante. And so it's like, I think the best Friday the 13th is Friday the 13th Part 6, right? Like, I don't think, now that's not always the, like Nightmare on Elm Street 3, you can make an argument is the best in the franchise. I think right. I prefer one, but it's pretty close, right? And the goal should always be like, the fact that it's a sequel, the fact that it's a safe proposition means that you should make it as unsafe as possible, right? Like, you should do something that just feels radical. So whether it's a sequel or a new thing, the goal is always to like have the thing you're doing right now be the best thing you've done yet. And that really is how we try to roll.
Well, you guys are definitely doing it. Again, thank you so much for coming on, just dropping so many gems. I also added some movies to my watch list that you mentioned, which I love that.
I'll give one more recommendation that's not gnarly at all. It's like a Drag Me to Hell, The Ring, you know, Smile, if whatever. But there is a classic horror movie called Night of the Demon. By Jacques Turner. I did a Trailers from Hell on this movie, but I love it. It's from 1955. It's black and white. There's no decapitations. It's not very bloody, but it's amazing. If you love The Ring, if you love Drag Me to Hell, if you love Hereditary, if you love It Follows, this is the movie that a lot of those movies were ripping off. It holds up very well. It's 1408. It's another movie I love that really rips this movie off. This movie is... it's just, if you want to watch a movie from the 1950s, so you can feel sophisticated, and as I like to, you know, so you can convince yourself that what we're doing is culturally important, which I'm just joking. Like, obviously, like, if you want to watch a movie, like, see the evolution of the genre, this is one of the all-time great horror movies. It's like, one of the OG curse movies. It's based on a short story by M.R. James, who was, like, a late 19th century academic at Cambridge, who was Lovecraft King... etc. before they existed, like before they were writing, like he is the original horror writer in the way that we perceive horror writers today, and basically wrote the template for both cosmic horror and like emotional spiritual humanist horror that like became the Twilight Zone King oeuvre. He wrote the short story that Night of the Demon is based on, and you're just gonna see so many of your favorite movies showcased in this movie. You know, yeah, those are a couple of
solid okay, ones. Awesome. I've always heard of this movie, but I have not watched it. So I'm gonna move it up on the list so I can check it out.
Yeah, it's a really good time. It's a really good time. Okay. But awesome. Thank you so much for making the time for this and letting me talk horror.
Of course. And you're welcome back anytime. I wish that you would just stay forever, but
thank you.
I know you're busy.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Listen, like genuinely, I make these movies for the horror community. Like genuinely, it is an obsession of mine. And you know, again, like that feeling that we get when we experience something that immediately feels iconographic is right. It gets me high. I get high on the feeling of, you know, getting to play in that world. And so again, like I would pay to do this job. I would do it for free, obviously, if I would pay for it. So the fact that, you know, the fact that people actually pay for these things and support original horror, is immensely moving to me and allows for more of it. And, you know, again, yeah, thank you everybody who watches our movies and just watches good movies in general. And, you know, and, hopefully some, thank you all so much.
Thank you. All right. And that's the Bloody Disgusting podcast for this week, everyone. We hope that your week has been filled with the best kind of horror. So yeah. Okay. Bye.
Thank you so much.